Pharma Talk Radio. I'm Valerie Bowling, producer of the show. Pharma Talk Radio is a nonprofit program disseminating helpful information to those in life sciences and, in particular, drug development. Today's program is dedicated to a new economic solution to drive cures to patients. I first heard of the topic through my colleague and friend, Dr. Tomas Sablinski, who is the founder and CEO of Transparency Life Sciences. Tomas, who I consider to be one of the more disruptive doers in the industry, highly recommended having the speaker behind this topic at both our DPharm US and Boston events, and indeed we did to great reviews. So it is my pleasure to welcome our guest host, Bruce Bloom, who is the president and CSO at Cures Within Reach. So Bruce, welcome.
Thank you, Valerie.
And Bruce, before we introduce your panel guests, can we start with an overview of the challenges you and your colleagues are trying to solve, and then we can go from there?
Sure. So the big challenge that we're trying to solve is that there's 7,000 diseases that don't have a medical solution right now. There's no treatment for it. There's no drug or device or any other way of solving this disease. And there's thousands of them across the globe. And that affects about 500 million people who go to sleep every night not having a treatment for whatever they're suffering from, and in many cases thinking that there's no hope that they'll find one in their lifetime. And the opportunity is that there are thousands of drugs that are already approved for human use, and there are thousands of more natural substances like vitamins and minerals, all available for human use, and many of those could be repurposed to treat an unsolved disease. And what we mean by repurposing is taking that drug in its existing form, in its existing dosage, and testing it in a new disease to see if it could provide some or all of the necessary solution to treat that disease. So what many of us on this call think about is that the solution to a lot of unsolved disease is already at the pharmacy or the chemist. We just don't know what drug it is. And there's strong scientific evidence, and sometimes there's strong evidence that doctors and patients have that a drug that's approved for one disease might actually work in another disease. So there's the opportunity. Now, why don't we do more of that? Because when we look at a generic drug, which is a drug that's been being used for many years, and so there's no more patent protection, lots of companies manufacture it, and it's inexpensive, there's no economic incentive for a pharmaceutical company to test whether that drug can work in the second or third or fourth different disease. Because if they spend a lot of money to prove that, there's no way for them to get that money back when the drug sells for maybe 5 cents a pill. And so there's no reason why they would spend millions of dollars doing this kind of proof work when they won't get their money back. And so this group that we've assembled today and others that are helping us started to think through, could we create a new economic engine that would provide an incentive for people to undertake this kind of repurposing research? And we've come up with this idea that instead of trying to make money by selling the drug for a lot of money out in the marketplace, what we found is in many cases that these drugs, because they're so cheap and they become so effective in the new disease, they save a lot of healthcare dollars. And so if we could capture some of that healthcare savings and use it as money to pay back investors to provide an incentive for the repurposing of generic drugs, we might create a whole new marketplace and a whole new reason why people would undertake this kind of research. And the benefit is that we could quickly get treatments to patients that aren't going to have any other solution and that nobody else is going to undertake this. So this group that we'll talk with today and others that are helping us are really trying to push this to the forefront so we can quickly get more treatments to more patients using the repurposing of generic drugs.
Okay, Bruce, thank you for that introduction. And so let me let you take over and introduce the panel guests, and then I'd love to hear about your journey, how this came together, and how it's going, of course.
Great. So three of my colleagues have joined on the call today, and they're actually the ones that are doing the bulk of the work. So let me introduce each of the three of them, and then I'll turn it over to each one to talk about what they're doing as part of this and what the benefit will be to both the patients, the physicians, the researchers, the investors, and in this case, the taxpayers of England, and how we're bringing this all together. So the first person I want to introduce is James Potter, who is an investment director at Numbers for Good. And Numbers for Good is a company that's out in the marketplace helping groups like ours organize the finance part of this kind of venture, which we call a social impact bond. And I'll turn it over to James in a second. But I also want to introduce Dr. Rick Thompson, who is the chief scientific officer at a nonprofit in England called Numbers for Good. It's a UK-based nonprofit that focuses on rare diseases. And also Flora Rafai. Flora is the executive director of Find a Cure, and they've both joined us. And Find a Cure is the sort of central hub for this social impact bond effort in England. And Rick and Flora can talk about what Find a Cure is doing and why we've focused our attention on England in the first place. So I'm going to turn it first over to James. So James, can you tell us a little bit about what Numbers for Good has done, the social impact bonds you've been involved with, and what kind of benefit those are bringing to the population in England, and also what you're going to be doing on the social impact bond that we're working on for the repurposing of generic drugs for rare diseases?
Thank you very much for that introduction, Bruce. Numbers for Good is a new organization we've been running for about 3 years, and we specialize in introducing social investors to social enterprises and charities who are looking to scale up their social impact. Obviously, medical impact could be one form of social impact, but there are a number of others, including things like elderly care and reducing prison reoffending rates and that sort of thing. The core idea at the heart of this project is a payment by results contract, and they've evolved over a number of decades as a way for governments to contract work. And whereas service contracts, which are more traditionally widely used, result in an organization paying for a service irrespective of whether outcomes are reached or irrespective of the outcomes, payment by results contracts are contracts designed to facilitate a specific outcome. And in the event that the outcome is not reached or a result is not achieved, there would be no payment. And so in the UK in the last 3 or 4 years, the space has become increasingly popular. And one of the ways in which the Cabinet Office within the UK government has decided to increase the use of payment by results contracts is to allow charities to participate in them. But they have an inherent disadvantage because charities don't have existing working capital that enables them to run a service in the time that it takes to produce a result. And so what needs to happen is some financing needs to be provided to the charity in the year or so, let's say, that takes place in the run-up to a result being achieved. And that financing is called a social impact bond. And social impact bonds are increasingly popular in the UK. There are about 4 or 5 in operation in the United States. And what they typically do is they allow a commissioner, which is usually a national government or a local government, to pay for a service, which is only triggered in the event that results are achieved. In the meantime, the charity is financed by a social impact bond. So that's the broad concept. In this particular circumstance, the results that we're trying to achieve is that we're trying to improve the well-being and the quality of life for people who suffer from very specific rare diseases. And we try to do that by repurposing drugs. So what we might, for instance, try and do over a one-year period is see if we can reduce operations in a particular cohort in that one-year period. And if we have prevented any operations from being needed in that particular cohort, that may have saved £100,000 for, in our case, the National Health Service, we might then be able to persuade the National Health Service at the end of the year to pay the £100,000 or a portion of it to the charity. And the charity can then use that to pay back the investor who's paid all of the salaries and the costs for delivering the intervention in the year that the service has been provided. And in a nutshell, that's what we're trying to do, and that's an overview of the payment by results model and social impact bonds.
Great. Well, thanks for that explanation. And so what I just heard you say is, for example, we would take a group of patients who might need some kind of expensive operation to treat their rare disease, and by giving them a repurposed drug, we might eliminate the need for that expensive operation. And at the end of a year or 2 years, this group of patients is healthy without having spent the taxpayers' money for that treatment. And that savings, a portion of it might be used to pay back the investors who helped us fund the research that showed that that particular drug in that rare disease would make sure that the patients didn't need the surgery in the first place.
Absolutely. So the investment, the upfront investment, is the investment that pays for the clinical trials and the medical process which has to be undertaken in order to prove that the drug does what we think it might do and take it to a stage where it is usable and that patients are actually feeling the results. As soon as the patients are feeling the effect of the results and their positive effects, then hopefully payments will be made by the payer, who in this case is ultimately the British government.
Great. And also, as future patients contract that particular disease and this treatment continues to work for them, this drug repurposing treatment, none of those patients need to go through the surgery. So the savings increases each year, and the number of patients that are getting better increases each year. So there's a benefit to the government and taxpayers and a continued benefit to any patient who has that particular disease over the long term.
Absolutely. Typically, social impact bonds are run over a 5, perhaps 6 year period, and that's typically because investors want their money back after 5 or 6 years to invest in alternative opportunities. But it's undoubtedly the case, and in fact, I was speaking to Rick a bit earlier today, that the savings in this space are generated in some cases potentially in perpetuity, but definitely in the long term. And so therefore, there's a significant amount of savings generated both in the first few years in which a new drug could be repurposed, but also in the years after the project is finished.
Great. So let's bring in Rick and Flora to talk about why Find a Cure is attracted to this particular opportunity and the kind of work, Rick, that you're doing on the science side and Flora that you're doing on the administration side to attract more attention and to get this organized in England. And Rick, you've been in on this since you and I first met, and tell us why you think we started in England. What's the benefit of working with the English government? And so, Rick, I'll turn it over to you first, and then you and Flora can explain some of the benefits to the patients in England and why we're doing it there.
Sure thing. Thanks very much, Bruce. So the real reason to try and work with this in England is obviously because of the unique NHS that we have, the unique National Health Service. There's really a single healthcare provider for pretty much anyone who lives in the UK. All the treatments that they experience, whether they're through diagnosis, right through to treatment or palliative care, are going to be delivered through the NHS. And this means there's a single payer, a single person that's controlling the budget that we're hopefully trying to target with a social impact bond. What's really unique, therefore, is we can target any aspect, any stage of that delivery of treatment for, in particular, Find a Cure's case, rare diseases. And hopefully, if we can save the NHS money through delivering a new generic drug to treat the patients, which will hopefully improve the patient outcomes, we can definitely save them money. And if we save that money, we can access the savings to potentially make this structure function. And it's a really appealing system. When you compare it to, say, a health insurance system like you have out in the US, you have these multiple different payers and different stakeholders that really are the gatekeepers to the funding and to deliver the treatments to the patients. And that's a much harder system in which to set up a social impact bond structure, because you have to negotiate the contractual terms with all of these different payers. So with the NHS and in the UK, it's really about having the single point of access, which admittedly is the government. So they've got a huge wealth of data, of knowledge, experience and expertise, which we can also access through them as well. So a real key stage in the project has been establishing partnerships with the NHS to understand how they view this type of project, this type of funding mechanism and the work we're trying to do. So that's kind of the reason we've come in as a UK-based rare disease charity. We think, you know, the UK is a great place to try and set up a kind of pilot study to see how a social impact bond can be used in drug repurposing. So I'll probably hand over to Flora now just to give you a bit of a background on Find a Cure itself and why we're interested in this type of work and why we've come into this partnership with Bruce. It really all started before I joined the charity in May last year.
So yes, Find a Cure is really interested in this field because the aim of the charity is really to build the rare disease community to drive research and develop treatments. A core part of what we believe at the charity is that patients and patient groups play an incredibly important role in promoting research. They have the knowledge and expertise around rare diseases specifically. They are the ones who are living with it. They know how the disease progresses, and so their voice is incredibly important. And what we saw with this model, with the social impact bond model, is a way to bring in patient groups that are very small, don't have a lot of funding, but have interesting ideas and interesting collaborations with different researchers and healthcare centres around the UK, and give them a structure, give them a funding support to be able to bring some of these great repurposing ideas to patients. So that's a very key thing in this role, is that we're partnering with existing groups and existing clinicians to deliver this support.
Thanks, Flora and Rick and James. One of the things that I want our listeners to know is that while we're starting this social impact bond initiative in England, if we create a solution that works for one of these rare diseases in England, the great news is that it will work for patients in any other country where that repurposed drug is available. And eventually our goal is to not be doing this only in England, but to be doing this on a global basis where all countries are participating in this, and each country is paying a smaller portion of the pay for success amount to keep the social impact bond going, to repay the investors and to accrue more money so that more of these projects can be done. One of the really great advantages of this pay for success method is that there are so many diseases, over 7,000, there's so many drugs and nutraceuticals that can be repurposed, over 6,000, that we could continue to do this for many, many years and still have great opportunities to repurpose these drugs and nutraceuticals for new rare diseases. And so eventually we're trying to create for the taxpayers of the world, for the governments of the world, but especially for the patients and physicians of the world, a new way of quickly and safely arriving at treatments that will actually work for people. One of the huge benefits of doing a repurposed drug, not only is it inexpensive, but once the treatment is proven through a clinical trial to work, in many countries a physician can begin to prescribe that drug immediately for the patients that they treat that have that disease, even if it's not approved by a regulatory authority. So, for example, here in the United States, if research is done that shows that a drug works for a disease that it's not approved for, physicians can begin prescribing it the next day for their patients. And that's okay with the government. That's okay with the hospital in which they work. As long as there's proof that it works, it's legal for them to approve it, what we call off-label. And so while we wait for regulatory approvals and governments and payers to decide to do this, it's immediately available. So as opposed to new drug development, which can take anywhere from 10 to 16 years before a treatment is available, this could happen relatively quickly, within a year to 3 years of getting started in the research. And I wanted to give an example from our own research to show how powerful this kind of drug repurposing could be. And then I want to turn it back over to Rick to talk about the kinds of projects we're reviewing and some of the challenges that we're running into in finding the right kinds of projects to put in this model. So there's a rare disease called autoimmune lymphoproliferative syndrome, which is a mouthful. But what this disease is there are children that are born with a defect in their white blood cells, which are the cells that help keep us healthy by fighting infections. And in these children, the white blood cells don't ever die. They build up in the body until late in their teenage years. They've built up in so much of quantity that it blocks out all of the healthy tissues, and these children can die. And there's a drug that was originally approved for as an anti-rejection drug for transplants. So if you get a kidney transplant from another person, your body wants to reject it. And so this drug called sirolimus was used to keep a patient from rejecting a kidney or a liver that was transplanted. And it turns out that this drug, sirolimus, works in these kids that have autoimmune lymphoproliferative syndrome. And it works so well that when we give it to these kids, within 60 days, they go from all these accumulated white blood cells that aren't helping them, all of those disappear, and all of their white blood cells from then on act like a normal person's white blood cells. They stick around for about 3 or 4 weeks, then they get recycled and new white blood cells are produced. So these kids go from death's doorstep to an almost normal life in 60 or 90 days. And the impact on those kids is it gives them a normal life. They can go to school. They can learn to drive. They function just like their peers. And the benefit to society is when these kids are sick, it costs in U.S. dollars about $100,000 a year to take care of them because they're in and out of the hospital all the time. And as soon as they go on this drug, sirolimus, all of those medical needs disappear. And they're not hospitalized any more frequently than the other children that don't have the disease. So on average, we're saving about $95,000 per patient per year. And for the 600 kids in the U.S. that have this disease, that's a savings of almost $50 million a year. And it only cost us $250,000 to do the clinical trial, and it took less than 3 years from the time we started that research until the paper was published that proved that it worked. And within 3 months of that paper being published, physicians from all over the world were calling the researcher who did the research saying, I have a patient like this. How would I treat this patient? And so these kids immediately were starting to get this treatment. And it's a really great example of the benefit to the patients, their families, the physicians, and also to the taxpayers and the other payers who were bearing the cost of this this disease. And one interesting thing that I also want to point out, it's not even just the direct medical costs, because in one of the families we know that has a child with autoimmune lymphoproliferative syndrome, because this young woman was in the hospital so often, the mother had to stop working. So the family lost her entire salary, and the father had to cut back on his work because this little girl that's sick has two brothers that need to be taken care of. And so this family lost about three-quarters of their income and had all sorts of other expenses. And this little girl wasn't getting to school, so she needed a tutor. And so there's all these indirect expenses that are saved as well, because now mom is back to work, dad is back to work full-time, the child doesn't need any tutoring. So it's a huge example of the kind of good that this can do. And there would be no reason that any company would undertake the repurposing of sirolimus for this rare disease because you never could get your money back. So that's an example from Cures Within Reach, from the not-for-profit that I run here in the States, of how we've done this. And we use philanthropic money. But imagine if we had gotten a part of that $50 million of savings, we could have paid back the donor that gave us the money for the $250,000 clinical trial, we would have had lots extra left over to start doing more of this kind of rare disease research. So, Rick, I want to turn it back over to you to talk a little bit about the kinds of projects we're looking at and some of the challenges in determining both on the scientific side, and maybe you and Flora and James can talk about some of the challenges on the demonstrating the cost-saving side that we've hired Costello medical to evaluate. So, Rick, I'm going to turn it over to you to talk about the science, and then Flora and James can talk about some of the financing.
Sure thing, Bruce. Thanks. I mean, first thing, just before I get too much into the project, is just to reiterate something you've been talking about. I mean, when we're looking at rare diseases, which is a big focus for us, it's really important that you remember how unlikely it is for many of these patients to have a hope of any treatment. You're really looking at populations that are often very isolated, that often have very little research done on them at all. And you can completely understand from a pharma perspective how hard it is to recoup your investment on such tiny populations, and especially when you're talking about repurposing generic drugs, because it's very hard to secure any IP to protect that investment. But there really is a vast need for the treatment for these patients, and a vast need for a route that can convincingly provide them, and that's really the core aim of what we're all trying to do here. And I think your illustration with ALPS hopefully kind of gives a window into some of the problems that the families face around the societal cost of this, as well as the pure cost to the healthcare providers. So it's really important to just appreciate that and draw a line under it, I think. So in terms of what we're trying to do with Find a Cure, we've got a grant actually to try and develop this idea in more detail. So to move it beyond the stage where we can describe the basic premise, the basic model to the people we talk to, and actually put specific models and numbers in place based around specific diseases. So over the past few months, we've been working particularly on a disease called congenital hyperinsulinism, which I'll call CHI, which is how we talk about it, it's much simpler. And this is a disease that affects children from birth. And essentially, they're born with a pancreas that's hyperactive. It's producing huge amounts of insulin. It's no longer making this hormone in relation to blood sugar levels. It's just picking out insulin into the bloodstream at a really high rate. So what insulin does is essentially causes sugar, causes glucose to be pulled from the bloodstream into the cells. And this essentially means a low blood sugar level. And the blood sugar is crucial. It provides the fuel to keep the brain working. So pretty much from the first day they're born, these kids are in real serious danger. They often appear very lifeless, blood glucose drops very low, they may experience seizures. And if this goes on for a prolonged period of time and isn't stopped, you can see brain damage occurring very quickly, and children can even die of it. It's obviously a really terrifying situation that the parents find themselves in as well. In the UK, there's a specialist service that treats congenital hyperinsulinism, and there are two sites, one in the north of the UK around Manchester and one in London at Great Ormond Street Hospital. And ultimately, in the most severe cases of this disease, the kids are generally transported to one of these centres under intensive specialist care, where the diagnosis will kind of be drilled down. So there are two major types of CHI. The first is called a focal CHI. And this really means that the cells that are overproducing insulin are focused in a small region of the pancreas. And what this means is it's quite possible to do a nice surgery to target those cells and remove them and effectively cure the problem. However, if you've got a diffuse CHI, you have a much, much bigger issue. These cells are spread throughout the pancreas, okay? And this means that you can't easily target them. It means the whole pancreas effectively would have to be removed to cure it effectively. So currently, that's what happens in the most of the cases. If they're not responding to a couple of other drugs, the only option would be a full pancreatectomy. So this is a big, expensive operation early in life, which is also just leaving kids with a lifelong problem, lifelong diabetes. And that's clearly a very disadvantageous solution. It's just not great. What the team at Great Ormond Street have been doing is looking at the drug sirolimus once again, because this drug works on a pathway called the mTOR pathway, which seems to hit a whole range of different sites and pathways in the body. One particular effect of it seems to be to suppress the body's response to insulin. So what this essentially means is that it seems that kids who are given sirolimus really reduce their response to insulin to such a degree that even diffuse CHI patients can begin to regulate their blood glucose in a more normal way. And this is clearly a much preferable situation to having a full pancreatectomy and living with diabetes for life. And that's particularly the case when you consider that it seems that the disease seems to burn out naturally after a few years. So as kids are approaching 3 to 5 in age, it seems that these hyperactive cells are burning out, they're dying off, or maybe they're not proliferating at the same rate. So their bodies naturally begin to recover. So what we're looking at is to try and understand the cost of these two different pathways. So to do this, we've got a company here in the UK called Costello Medical Consulting, who are helping us to build cost of illness and budget impact models into CHAI. So in the cost of illness model, they've been working really extensively with the team at Great Ormond Street. We're wading through the literature, looking at the collection of nationally available data on NHS costs to try and understand what this disease actually costs the NHS currently. Now, it's actually a very, very ultra rare disease, so the absolute number for the cost for the NHS is maybe a drop in the ocean. But when you realise the number of patients that's spanning across, it's a sizable proportion. So they've built this model using all this data. We're working with the GOSH team, like I said, to validate it. And we've also then built a model which says, what is the effect on the NHS budget if we replace these pancreatectomies, these really invasive surgeries, with the treatment of sirolimus? And using this model, we're hoping to be able to demonstrate that we can save good amounts of money to the NHS and therefore validate the social impact on the model, show we can save them money, and therefore if we can access those savings, we can fund the trial. So that's the focus of our work. It's been going quite well. We're at a good stage now where we've got a level of savings demonstrated which definitely would cover the price of the trial and beyond. So I believe in the current model, at a five-year time horizon, we're looking at saving in the region of £500,000 in the UK. And we're looking at an annual cost for sirolimus around the £4.5 million mark. So it's a sizable portion of the budget that can be reduced through this. And indeed, the time horizon we're using isn't particularly favourable for CHAI as well, which is something I was discussing with James earlier. And we think there are very large long-term savings, which we're not currently looking at. So that's really the work we're doing there. And this is the type of model we're hoping to roll out across a number of different rare diseases. And it's all about just trying to demonstrate this in really robust terms, because it's important to convince a government body, the National Health Service, that we're very serious and we can present robust data to show them they can save money and really make this model work. So that's what we're working on now. And as Bruce has mentioned, finding rare diseases that fit the profile is possible, but we really need every bit of help we can get. And you know, if there's anyone listening to this podcast who think they have ideas or thoughts on rare diseases that could be targeted and could fit into this model, we'd be very keen to hear about it. I don't know if, Bruce, there are certain areas you'd like me to discuss that we're around the types of rare diseases we're targeting and the issues we're finding. Is there anything that leaps to mind that you think you'd like me to cover?
I think you covered it well. I mean, we're certainly looking for serious diseases that are, you know, either life-threatening or chronically debilitating for these patients, so that we both can help a population that is desperately in need of finding a solution and have the benefit of saving the families, the patients, and the healthcare system a significant amount of cost if we can provide some kind of a solution. So, Flora, I'm wondering if you could just help us understand what our connection is right now to the National Health Service in England and what way they're participating in the development of this social impact bond initiative.
Sure. So the NHS has been very receptive to this idea so far. So last September, we got a letter of interest from them, which signified that they are interested in seeing how this project turns out. And we've been working very closely with them. We've got someone who is quite high up within the NHS who's giving us a lot of guidance and input on the project in its development. And it's an area that's quite interesting to them as well, with not just within the UK, but on a global scale, healthcare budgets are being put massively under strain with aging populations. And this sort of project that is for non-profits and it's saving money but also bringing patient benefit is one that's very interesting to them. So we're hoping through this proof of concept that Rick outlined, where we're looking at CHAI and we're going to be considering two other rare diseases, to show that we can reduce costs and improve patient care, and hopefully that will lead to a formal arrangement with the NHS where they will agree to the social impact bond and we can get started with trials within a year or so.
Thanks for sharing that. Yeah, it's very exciting. The interesting reason that we started in England with this was that we had a contact over there who worked with the National Health Service, Edmund Jessup, who was very eager to help us with this idea of repurposing drugs for rare diseases. And Edmund works very closely with the rare disease focus that the NHS has. And so he was our initial sort of government person in some government in some country that was the first one to say, this sounds like a really good idea. It's fast, it's safe, it's inexpensive. We don't have to pay unless there's a success. It's focused on patients who normally would be left out of the medical research pipeline. It's repurposing drugs that are already safe and inexpensive. It makes so much sense, except there's no economic incentive to do it. And so Edmund was the one that originally connected us to the government and showed that there was some interest, which is why we have this focus and partnership with Find a Cure, which is the premier organization in England focused on rare diseases. So it's really exciting that there's a government out there that has taken such an interest, and they've actually assigned a specific person to work with us who was with us at the DPharm Europe conference. And so it's really energizing, and it allows me to go around the rest of the world and begin to talk to other governmental officials joining this, because our hope is that if we can kick this off in England, that maybe some of the other European Union countries and even the United States and Canada might join this initial social impact bond. Imagine if we had another country, even the same or larger than England, that was participating, and we could increase the number of patients that benefited from this, as well as the amount of funding that it would bring back in for us to do more of this work. And one of the other things I wanted to mention as we think about benefits of this is that the patients that get to enroll in these clinical trials immediately get the potential benefit of this treatment. And for some of these rare diseases, it's a large portion of the patient population that would participate in the clinical trial. So not only are we trying to develop a new therapy, but for some patients, they get it immediately. And if it works, they're getting this treatment right away. So we're not even, in some cases, waiting 1 to 3 years for the results. We're seeing it right away. And in that example that I gave with sirolimus and autoimmune lymphoproliferative syndrome, these children were literally getting better in 60 or 90 days after going on the regimen of sirolimus. And these are kids, some of whom had had this disease for 10 to 12 years and were hospitalized about 50% of their lives. And suddenly, like a miracle, they take two pills a day and they're almost normal. And it gives me goosebumps just to think about what it must have been like for those families to suddenly see their child getting healthy so quickly. James, I want to turn it back over to you for a minute. And can you share with us the kinds of funders that typically are drawn to a social impact bond like this, and why they're motivated to participate in these kinds of initiatives?
Yeah, Bruce, sure. As I said earlier, the sector has been growing in the UK over the last 5 or 6 years, ultimately sponsored by the government. You see it as an interesting area to encourage charities to get involved in payment by results contracts. There are about 25 social impact bonds already in operation in the UK. None of them, whilst some of them are on the edge of the medical sector, most of them are in more traditional social services spaces. And they have a wide range of investors who've provided the capital to allow those charities to deliver their services. There are two funds which are quite notable, which specialize in investing in social impact bonds. One is a fund run by a fund manager called Bridges that specializes in investing in these types of projects. And there is another fund that's just being started by an organization called Social Finance, which will also invest almost exclusively in social impact bonds going forwards. Outside that area, there are three or four funds who have a objective to create social impact and at least return their underlying investors their capital at the end of a 5 to 10 year investment period. And they are not often focused on social impact bonds, which for obvious reasons have a number of risks that a normal bond wouldn't, but they're willing to consider social impact bonds. And there's about 3 or 4 organizations in that category in the UK. The last category that's quite interesting is philanthropic foundations. Typically, they allocate a certain amount of money to provide to charitable organizations in the form of grants. And that's traditionally been done over the last hundreds of years. But increasingly, we're finding that philanthropic organizations and also their founders are interested in perhaps recycling some of that capital. So they may still continue to give grants, but they may reserve a portion of that grant money to invest in charities on the expectation that there's a good chance they'll get some of it back 5 years later, and they can then reuse that capital in another charity, and so on. And so over 10, 20 years, they might have invested in 3 or 4 charities to help them scale up, rather than, in the case of a grant, have provided capital to one charity who has then kept it. So that's a sort of increasing phenomena in the UK context. I believe it's a similar backdrop in the United States. And just one other thing I wanted to pick up on, Bruce, that you mentioned what are the challenges. I mean, that there are some significant challenges on this project. One is related directly to the investors. It's challenging to find investors who are willing to invest on the basis that there's a strong chance that the drug may not be successful. And so in order to allay those fears, we've determined at this stage to set up a project which looks to repurpose a number of drugs, focusing on a number of diseases. And so the idea is, if and when we set up the final social impact bond, we would aim to set it up with probably between 8 to 10 diseases and 8 to 10 drugs we're looking to repurpose to treat those diseases. And on that basis, if we have a success rate of, say, 3 to 5 of the 8 achieving their targets, and 1 being close and 2 failing, we can still likely give investors a decent risk-reward balance. I think if we were to focus on one disease, it may be one way or the other. It might be a strong chance of success or a strong chance of failure, but hopefully with a portfolio approach, we can give an investor a more balanced risk-reward profile. And I think that's one of the biggest challenges. Another challenge is selecting the appropriate diseases and the appropriate drugs, because in some cases there's a lot of evidence, and it might be that, in fact, a risky finance project is not needed to finance it, because a grant provider or an NHS type organization might be willing to fund it because the evidence is so overwhelmingly strong. And in other cases, it might be so preliminary, the evidence, that there's a strong chance that the drug may not be successful. And in theory, those are the ones we should be trying to finance. But obviously, it's a lot harder to find the investors for those types of projects. So those, I think, are the two of the largest challenges in structuring the fund and encouraging people to part with their money to invest in these types of projects.
Great. Well, thank you for that. And a couple of other things that I want to share that are huge benefits of undertaking this social impact bond initiative. One is that if we can prove that there's value to be gained by saving healthcare dollars while we improve healthcare outcomes, it might not only be used for rare diseases, it certainly could be used for common diseases as well. The second thing is, if we validate this model, there are situations where pharmaceutical companies have solutions for patients with unsolved diseases, but because patents have run out on drugs and other kinds of things, there's no way for them to make money, and so they don't promote them. But if these pharmaceutical companies could get paid based on the healthcare savings that this new drug generates, even for some new drug development, this might create a solution that would allow these things to get to patients more quickly that would just sit on the shelves because there's no economic benefit. So we're not just trying to do something that could only happen in the philanthropic areas and just for rare diseases, but could happen also in the commercial area and for more common unsolved diseases, things like diabetes or infections or tuberculosis, malaria, and some of the large neglected diseases. So it's an exciting new development in both the way we would discover treatments for unsolved diseases and how we would finance them. And that's why, as a group, we're so excited to move this pilot project forward in England as quickly as possible. And so, you know, as we think about outreach and who else might come and join us to help, certainly, as Rick mentioned, if there are physicians and scientists out there who have ideas for the repurposing of drugs or nutraceuticals or devices for rare diseases, you can contact either me at Cures Within Reach, and our website is www.cureswithinreach.org, and all of our contact information is right there. You can call Rick or Flora at Find a Cure, and I'll let Rick and Flora give the email address, not the email address, but the website address for that. If you run an organization that might be interested in funding, you certainly could contact James at Numbers for Good, which is also on the web and easy to contact those people. And we're just really excited to think about how we can bring together the scientists, the patients, the patient advocates, the philanthropic funders, the government payers, all working together to try and make patients healthier at the same time as increase the funding for this kind of needed medical research. So I think we're getting towards the end of our opportunity here. So I think I'd like to turn it back over to Flora, Rick, and James just to tell people how they can get a hold of those organizations if they want to help and any last words that they might have. So Flora, why don't I turn it over to you first?
Yes, thanks. So if anyone will want to get in contact with Find a Cure with ideas or just general comments or suggestions for the project, they can find our website at www.findacure.org.uk, or they can email myself, Flora at findacure.org.uk, or rick at findacure.org.uk, and we are really open to any suggestions or comments as well, so please do get in touch.
Yeah, absolutely. I'll just reiterate what Bruce said. I mean, this is a really exciting project. It's fascinating to work on and brilliant to see the feedback we receive when we talk about it. So many people are enthusiastic, and I think the timing is great when we look at what James is talking about there. Social impact bonds are starting to take off, and we're at the kind of cusp here of trying to introduce this idea into the health system. And if it can take off, there's no reason it can't spread in a huge different ways to different countries and hopefully benefit patients of all kinds of diseases, not just rare, and make a big difference. So, you know, please do get in touch and share your thoughts. We really would appreciate all feedback.
James?
Numbers for Good have a website, which is www.numbersforgood.com, which should be very easy to get to and has all of our contact details on. And I would confirm what Rick said. You know, it's a fascinating area to examine, particularly in the context of social impact bonds. And, you know, in the broad spectrum of beneficiaries and people that can be helped by a social impact bond, you know, children, and in many cases, rare diseases, it's children affect. Who are suffering from these diseases are definitely at the, you know, tougher end of the spectrum, and you know, it'd be fantastic if we can set up a project which allows them to benefit from this process.
So it's Valerie here. I'm going to help close the show, but before I do so, I want to thank Bruce and Flora, James and Rick. Thank you so much for sharing your work and your progress with us. Bruce Bloom spoke at both the DPHARM Disruptive Innovations to Advance Clinical Trials conferences in Europe as well as in the U.S. Our next DPHARM event will take place September 20th to 21st in Boston. And for more information about other radio programs in the next DPHARM event, please visit us at www.theconferenceforum.org. Thanks so much, everyone, for a great show, great information.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for having us.
Thank you.